Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solari Report. I have with me, rejoining us from the last interview, Mary Holland, Vice Chairman and Attorney Extraordinaire from the Children's Health Defense. Mary, thank you so much for being with us. And I asked you to come back. I know you're in the middle of much very important work, but I wanted to explain to everybody what contact tracing is and why this is something we all have to do something about. So with no further ado, why don't you introduce to us what is contact tracing and why should we understand this? Why should we care?
So contact tracing, the concept, Catherine, has been around for hundreds of years, literally. And it's, you know, a rational, the core here is a very rational idea. If you have an outbreak of a dangerous infectious disease, especially early on in an outbreak, it makes all the sense in the world to isolate people who are sick and to quarantine people who have come in contact with the person who is infectious to make sure that the disease doesn't spread further. That's been used, you know, for a couple hundred years once people really understood how viral and bacterial diseases travel. That's pretty basic. And state in the United States, it's at the state level that is the authority for public health. And so states have pretty wide-ranging authorities to be able to do things like contact tracing. Now, one irony is that, for instance, over the last 5 years, when we had these horrible measles outbreaks in Disneyland and in Rockland County in Brooklyn, there was no contact tracing whatsoever used, none. There was no quarantine applied. There, the state's objective was clearly to absolutely inundate people with fear about measles in order to get rid of religious exemptions and personal belief exemptions to foster the vaccines. Here, the contact tracing that they're talking about now, probably at least 6 months past the start of this viral infectious epidemic, if not longer, it makes very, very little sense, Catherine, because right. What we know is this is on par with the severe seasonal flu. We also know there are some very good treatments that unfortunately are being very actively suppressed by the powers that be. And what this dimension of contact tracing looks like to me is a way to keep the fires burning so that people will feel absolutely desperate to get a vaccine. So what is the contact tracing that's being used now? So the idea now is that, like in certain Asian countries, in China and South Korea and Singapore, they use apps. They use contact tracing apps. And that seems to be the backbone of what they're going to be doing in this country, Catherine. So Apple and Google have both jointly sort of come up with an app that is being downloaded into people's phones. And right. If these contact tracers who are being funded at the state and federal levels, if they identify one person who has become infectious, they will look at your location tracker on your phone. They will see if that person came into contact with anyone else. They'll also ask that person, you know, on a phone call, who else did you come into contact within the last 10 days? And then all of those people will be contacted, and all of those people will be voluntarily asked to quarantine. And the quarantine is that's a healthy person, but you came into contact. The idea is you might have become infectious. So you would have to be isolated in your home for 14 days. If you were sick, that you'd be quarantined, for 14 days. If you were sick, they would require you to isolate for at least 10 days and have 3 days of no fever after it. These are sort of the guidelines that Johns Hopkins has put out there for contact tracers. Some states, Washington State, for example, if you only have one bathroom, they're saying that that's not good enough if you're sharing that bathroom with other people. And so that then may require the person who's been exposed or the person who's sick to go into some kind of quarantine facility, about which I have, you know, grave reservations about these facilities. But this is what's being sort of rolled out. So California has 20,000, New York State is hiring them. You know, in an era right now, Catherine, where millions, tens of millions of people have been thrown out of work, it's really fascinating to see all of the sort of perquisites that are being advertised about these contact.
The pay scales, the pay scales in this environment are quite plush.
They're quite high. So in New York State, for instance, I'm looking at, you know, it's $21 an hour. It's saying there's paid sick leave, medical and dental coverage, you know, full-time, part-time, tips, commissions, bonuses, store discounts. I mean, it's really quite fascinating. And in particular, they're looking for contact tracers, many of whom are personal care associates. They have a license, the ones in New York. These are people with no medical training per se. And these are going to be, you know, potentially good jobs in a terrible economy.
Right. Now, let me point something out. I was just reading a quote that Sophia Smallstrom used on a book about the perfect enemy and how the perfect enemy is an enemy that in fact doesn't exist. Because if you want perpetual war, then you can't get rid of the enemy and the war can go on forever. But that means you need an invisible enemy. Right. So they were referring to the war on terrorism. But when you look at so the coronavirus is something that's in most of us have it in our body already.
Absolutely.
And most of the people who test positive are asymptomatic. It doesn't mean that we're sick.
No, it does not.
Right. And so and there's a question of whether or not you are infectious if you have, but we'll put that aside. And we also know that the tests are very unreliable.
Correct.
And we know that in most cases, the virus is not does not cause a serious disease.
Correct.
So we have something that almost everybody is positive with that doesn't make a lot of people sick and without reliable tests.
Well, I don't know that everybody is positive yet, Catherine. I mean, that's an interesting point, you know. So coronavirus, there's like over 200 viruses in the coronavirus family. And coronavirus is associated with the common cold. It can be associated with flus. This particular one is from the SARS family, right, which was a more serious illness like 10 years ago.
Right.
There's a lot of questions on what is the origin of this coronavirus, but you're 100% correct that the testing so far is highly unreliable. The CDC's test that came out was garbage. They rejected better tests that were available elsewhere in the world that likely did contribute to some of the problems that we've had here in the United States. But we have no idea what these tests really mean. We have no idea if you have antibodies, if it means that you will never get sick again, if you don't have antibodies, that you're more susceptible. These mostly aren't antibody tests. They're PCR tests to see whether you're infectious. These tests also are not reliable. So the whole thing is as you point out, it's the perfect enemy, right? It's shifting, it's unclear, it's uncertain, and yet there's enormous fear around it. I mean, the meta-analyses, I mentioned to you, I think a really outstanding article about what's been happening for the last few months is the article called Lockdown Lunacy by J.B. Handley.
Very good.
And it's on a blog, the J.B. Handley's blog. And, you know, he points out that this scientist at Stanford University, Ioannidis, not only did an initial study saying, you know, it really looks like the infection fatality rate is about 0.2%, 0.2% of all the people who get infected with this particular virus, as far as we understand it, are going to die from it. Very, very low. It's people who are elderly, people with comorbid conditions. It is not something that is going to fell most people. And then he did a meta-analysis of 12 other studies on what is the infection fatality rate. And again, it comes out to about 0.2. And even Tony Fauci on the coronavirus task force, much in the news, said in an article in the New England Journal of Medicine, it's probably more akin to a severe seasonal flu.
Right.
0.2%. So would we do this for the flu that comes around every year? Would we do this for common colds? We don't do this for, you know, we don't do this for anything else. And we know this isn't very serious. But I think you and I have done our homework and we kind of are independent thinking. And so we're not afraid to say, this is overblown, way overblown. This is serving other purposes. Right. But I don't know about you, Catherine. I do have a lot of friends and family, you know, who don't read what I read, who don't watch what I watch, and they are living in panic. They are genuinely, if they just watch mainstream news and they watch TV, they are living in panic. They have been afraid to leave their homes. They genuinely believe that if somebody doesn't wear a mask, they're at tremendous risk from that person. They believe that the most casual contact could lead to their death. And it's you know, and I try gently to send them, you know, the J.B. Handley article and so on, but it's very, fear is very powerful. Fear is what has always been used to induce change, right? Fear and sort of base. So this fear is very, very effective. And I'm concerned that for people with low information about what is really going on, if they are contacted by a contact tracer on their cell phone or at their front door, and the person says, "We believe that you have recently been exposed, and I know that you as a good citizen don't want to infect others with this deadly virus, and we don't want you to infect your family members," I think there are going to be people who are genuinely are going to welcome that. You know, and what the mantra, the political mantra is testing, tracing, isolate, right? This is how we are going to overcome this enemy, the invisible enemy.
So here's the question. Are they really going to say, "Oh, it's fine if you take my 10 and 12-year-old children away and put them in a camp that you've created"?
So that was interesting, Catherine. So we saw on a website for Washington State. An official, a public health official in Ventura, California, came out and talked about taking people out of the home. And he walked that right back. There was a huge amount of pushback. Washington State also had on its sort of job board, they said they were looking for people to supervise quarantine centers for children. And similarly, they got a huge amount of pushback. And then they put up on their website, "Oh, we want to clarify, that was not for everybody. That was just for children who are already under supervision of the state. These were for children who are in foster care or for in juvenile facilities." So I'm not saying this isn't possible, Catherine. It's clearly possible. But it's interesting to me that some of the trial balloons, the first states that are, you know, moving forward rapidly, they have been pulling that back somewhat. But at least some of them in Washington, they have talked about, if you only have one bathroom, that will not suffice for isolation if you live with other people. I watched a video, I think you've seen, of a young woman, it sounds like, who attended 9 hours of contact tracing education provided by Johns Hopkins, very much, you know, in the thick of all of this. And they said you can't even be with your pets. It's insane, right? You cannot be with your pet. I mean, I don't know how you'd take care of your pet, frankly. And I heard Governor Inslee of Washington say, "Well, you know, we hope that you're friends, but otherwise we will bring people in to help you and get your food and get your pharmacy." As I think I've said, Catherine, I think the great silver lining of this is that this is completely unenforceable. And I think that at the county and city level, there will be some people with common sense in their public health departments who say, "This is insane. There's no way we can make this happen. This is not solving our problems." I just think this is unenforceable, effectively. I don't think it's not a threat, but I think it's not doable.
So let me play devil's advocate, because as you know, I litigated with the Department of Justice for many, many years, and I watched them lie. I watched them break the law. I watched them falsify evidence. Mm-hmm. And I was quite lucky for a variety of reasons. You know, I was able to put many layers between them and me, mm-hmm. you know, and I worked the situation, and I had a general counsel who had absolute integrity and was fearless. Mm-hmm. So I came out relatively unscathed. But I know how intimidating that process can be if you didn't have my kind of training and my kind of resources. That's number one. But number two, given that I've seen the law misused to that extent as a political tool, the ability to use contract tracing as a political tool, you know, if you're coming into a community and you want to take over a particular market share, and you want to make sure that those five businessmen have to get quarantined in their house while you're doing whatever, you know, the uses of this to poach assets.
I totally agree with that. The opportunities for abuse here are enormous. So one of the points I wanted to make, Catherine, is this is really a conversation about the police power. This is about the state's police power. And we're having a broader national conversation, whether, you know, a lot to say about it, but we're having a conversation about abuse of the police power. So I am completely in accordance with you that this is a new police power that is not very few strictures, you know, a great sense of emergency. There's going to be petty tyrants in this, people who couldn't get jobs elsewhere who are going to use their power to the fullest. And is this right for abuse? Absolutely. 100%. This is right.
And here's the thing. If we were talking about an infectious disease where you had highly reliable tests, and if a politically motivated effort against a person said you were positive, it would be fairly easy for your general practitioner to prove you weren't, or to prove it didn't matter. You know, so if we had a highly distinct disease with highly reliable tests, it would be a totally different fact pattern. But from what I've seen of the fact pattern so far, you know, it's going to be relatively easy to get away with murder, I think. But the other thing that disturbs me, if you look at the people who first introduced this whole concept and were promoting it, it was one of the most lawless people I've ever dealt with, which is basically Clinton and Dershowitz. These are the guys who flew Epstein Air. So the guys who flew Epstein Air are putting into place a construct where they're saying they can come into your home and grab your kids. And I'm, you know, so that immediately sends the hackles up on the back of my neck, because I don't put, you know, there's certain people who politically, I don't put anything past right in the game of economic warfare. And so you add these police powers with people who are clearly very experienced and active in active, you know, economic warfare. And that starts to really scare me. But let me bring up another thing. If I was just watching an interview with Judy Mikovits where she's talking about how dangerous experiment, I won't even call them vaccines because I don't even think they're medicine. So if a whole series of experimental concoctions are rolled out and given to people, so Mikovits was talking about why she believes 50 million people could get killed as a result of this kind of experiment. If you're going to do that kind of experiment on people, wouldn't you want the power to do contact tracing to pull the people who've been made sick or gotten killed? Wouldn't you want to blame it on a invisible, mysterious virus, but have the ability to intercede?
I'm not sure I followed that last point.
So I'm assuming that Operation Warp Speed creates a whole series of injectable materials that they're going to argue is a vaccine. Okay.
Right.
And they're probably not going to be one, because you've got a lot of companies and it's politics. Right. So maybe you're going to try 10.
Right.
If you go to giving this to humans before you go through the complete
right
process to prove that it's, you know, or you go through animal trials, I'm assuming that you could do a lot of physical damage and harm to a lot of people.
Oh, sure. I think what you're suggesting, I think, is correct, Catherine. I think what happens with this squad, with these health forces, this health police that's essentially being set up, is I think it's quite likely that this then becomes the front groups for the vaccination, right? I think these become the vaccine squads. I think that's correct. And I think as soon as, you know, Operation Warp Speed comes up with these 10 poorly tested vaccines, for 20 years, they've been working on coronavirus vaccines unsuccessfully. What actually happens is somebody gets the vaccine, they have this virus in them, they're exposed to it, and it's called pathogenic priming. Basically, they get sicker than they otherwise would have, and they're more likely to die. So it could be potentially extremely dangerous, and that's not even talking about all of the vaccine add-ons that are absolutely not medicine, and you and I completely agree on that. So yes, do I think there's enormous risk here? Yeah, absolutely. I think that this is, I mean, President Clinton did talk about, I was just looking at something, you know, he wants to make these contact tracing forces permanent. He wants this to be AmeriCorps. He wants them to be operational indefinitely, right? I think part of this new, the new normal is trying to get people to subject themselves to regular vaccination, whether they call it COVID-19 or COVID-25 or whatever it is, and having digital surveillance and digital certificates for your vaccination status.
So I don't know if you saw this. I did an interview with Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, and she asked me what I would call them, because we're talking about sort of the gene manipulation aspect and the bioelectronics and nanotechnology and, the different. And I said, I don't know, because we're talking about a cocktail of different kinds of stuff. And I think we really need to understand what I call the creepy technology to come up with a name. So one of the viewers sent me, and we were talking, I was basically saying, just like they put Microsoft operating system in your computer with a back door, now they want to put it in your brain with a back door. And Dr. Tenpenny laughed, and she said, yeah, that's why they called it Windows. So one of the viewers emailed me and said, oh, I think we should call it Windows 1984.
I saw that, and I think that's terrific. I really do. And I think it is, I think when I always thought about Windows platform, I thought about it was like a window out, but of course it's really a window in.
Right.
And I think that these vaccines are absolutely 100% a window in. And as Gates would have it, based on his patents, it is brain-machine interface. It is looking in at the most intimate level, your blood rate, your brain waves. I mean, extraordinary.
I don't know if I think I sent you this. It was from the Financial Times. When Operation Warp Speed was announced, I was trying to figure out, okay, well, what's this about? So for the viewers who don't know about this, Operation Warp Speed is a public-private partnership between the U.S. government and a series of private companies, and it includes the Department of Defense, mm-hmm. to come up with COVID-19, supposedly, I'll call them injectables. And the person they put in charge of it was head of research at GlaxoSmithKline, and his lead expertise is on bioelectronics and brain-machine interface. And I thought, well, that's not subtle at all.
No, there's nothing subtle about this, Catherine. I mean,
right.
And one of the things you mentioned, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, I think she wrote an excellent piece that we put at the Children's Health Defense website and newsletter. We have no idea what any of these tests mean. Exactly what you're saying. They have no scientific significance today.
Right.
The infection doesn't tell you accurately whether you're infected or not. The antibody, the tests are not accurate. And we really don't know what antibody status means, even if it were an effective test. Clearly the vaccines are going to be based on this idea that they generate antibodies and those are protective, but we don't know that to be a fact at all. In
right.
fact, they may make you less protected against, what in some people is a serious disease.
Well, the history of testing of vaccines before they're rolled out, if I understand it correctly, we've never had real proof that any of this stuff is safe or effective.
I mean, what we have on the childhood schedule, which are the people that get vaccinated the most, and healthcare workers and elderly for flu shots. I mean, none of these vaccines that are federally licensed and then federally recommended have ever been tested against true saline placebos, which is astonishing. And what's happening right now with these coronavirus vaccine candidates, they skipped over animal trials in the Moderna public-private partnership with National Institute of Infectious Diseases and Allergies, Allergies and Infectious Diseases. I mean, these are especially scary vaccines. We have bad vaccines that cause enormous amounts of unacknowledged injury that were tested literally for, tens of years. And now we're going to go out with something that's been tested for a matter of months. I mean, it's interesting. One of the points about, the sort of the landmark case that allows for mandates, vaccine mandates, that was to mandate the smallpox vaccine. Smallpox was a seriously deadly disease. 30% of people who contracted the disease at that time died from it. But even that was a vaccine that had been around since the 1700s. I mean, it was not an unknown vaccine. Here, there's discussion of vaccines for something that has never existed but been worked on for decades and something they will have had a test on, testing for a couple months. I mean, it's really an astonishing, it's an astonishing thing that we're living through.
My guess is because I think this is all about police powers, you're absolutely right. My guess is the police powers will be effective at dealing with two things. The mess you make after everybody gets the experimental vaccines, and you'll be able to, one, clean up the mess and then blame it on the virus. So part of that is the cleanup of doing a giant experiment on a large general population. But the other is you're going to be implementing all sorts of very unpleasant economic activities and reengineering the economy and the government at the same time. And this is an unbelievably powerful political weapon. Now, let me just mention one other thing. I'm not current on the state of municipal services contracting, but when I was still active with government contracting, one of the things we were seeing was the defense contractors who were the most sort of, you know, deep black budget in Washington, in my experience, were picking up social service contracts around the country, including doing child services. And at the time, I was working with one reporter trying to bring transparency to the fact that one of these contractors had two pieces of litigation against them for sex slave trafficking in Eastern Europe. You know, they were a piece of work. But anyway, they were picking up contracts on social services and with children. And my concern, as you watch this push to defund the police, which is not, doesn't have a lot of popular support, but to the extent that you can get it done and swing that money over to social services, where I'm assuming the contract tracers will be, it's not going to be necessarily a group of public employees who are trained as social workers who are going to get that money. It's going to be these defense contractors who pop up overnight. Yeah. And if they have continued to be as aggressive about getting those contracts, my fear is you've already got a Stasi network in place that's ready to pop up as soon as you get the apps, the police powers, and the money.
Yeah, I think those are very real concerns, Catherine. I know much less about sort of those defense contractors. One of the things that I'm seeing is that there's been a sort of an army around this whole public health federal money trough for a long time. Right. And that infrastructure around HIV, malaria, tuberculosis, they've been around for a long time, Clinton Foundation, Gates Foundation. And those, you know, those entities are already, you know, they are scooping up all this money that is being generated with our taxpayer money at the state and the federal level. So they're already there and they're buzzing around and they're getting these contracts, you know, Partnership in Health and Echo Health Alliance, and there's lots of them. But I'm sure you're correct that there are new forces that have sort of a more military cast that are coming into this space.
Well, whenever the spigot turns on, you're just always amazed at who shows up. It's a, it's an equal opportunity trough. I want to talk about, there's an effort to now consolidate contact tracing from a state-controlled function into the federal government. So we see a bill, interestingly called, I have it here, H.R. 666. I mean, I'm holding it up because if somebody told me this, I wouldn't believe it. It's so,
I know. It's anyway. So outrageous. So, you know, I did a little video on that several weeks ago. So it's very interesting. We can talk about that was proposed by Bobby Rush. There's questions about he basically seems to potentially have come up with this idea last summer at a conference in Rwanda where it just so happened there were people from the Clinton Foundation and the Gates Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation and so on. But what's really interesting about that bill is it's an extraordinary bill about contact tracing, and it's to create it, you know, it was for $100 billion, it's to make it permanent, it's extremely vague, it could be used for vaccination, ultimately it could be used for a lot of things. But what's fascinating is that it had 52 or so co-sponsors, it had one Republican. The one Republican from Southern New Jersey withdrew his name from it, and that bill has gone nowhere. There's not a co-sponsor, and it's gone nowhere, and it's going nowhere. What's happened, though, it's almost as if that were sort of a decoy. The provision about basic contact tracing was moved over to H.R. 6800, sponsored by Nita Lowey of New York. And that bill did already pass the House. And that bill passed the House and had in it $75 billion for contact tracing. Now, speaking to contacts that I have on Capitol Hill, they say that that is called the HEROES Act for the healthcare workers and for infrastructure around health. That bill is dead on arrival in the Senate.
Right.
Mitch McConnell has said, we're not doing anything with that. But my intel from people on the Hill is that at some point that bill will have to move through the Senate, and it will likely be at a far lower level, but that there is going to be probably something like $25 billion sloshing around for contact tracing. That was my contact's prediction. There's also money that we know, Catherine, has been generated, particularly in blue states, New York, California, Washington. Right. And those states have already put this money forward. And, you know, especially Democratic politicians are saying testing, training, isolating, you know, creating a tracing army. I mean, they're using very, you know, militaristic vocabulary and are saying this is the only way out of our crisis. And I do think really it's fairly clear, Catherine, that what, you know, assuming that this virus has spread far and wide around the world, and it is frankly impossible to contain it at this point, it is just impossible. Right. What's going to, it's already mutated since it started in China. Scientists have already shown this. You know, if it follows the course of SARS and MERS, 2 years from now, this is completely done. If you look at that article I mentioned, Lockdown Lunacy, you know, viruses have a certain pattern and it follows what's called Farr's Law. And what it looks like for this is it peaks at 40 days and it's essentially gone after 70. So it keeps circulating, but it follows a very, very clear trajectory. So what's going to happen if they use this contact tracing, which makes no sense essentially because this virus has already spread so broadly, is that some people will be quarantined repeatedly. They will use their phone app. They will come in contact with somebody. A contact tracer will say, either do this voluntarily or we're going to put you under a detainment order and we're going to basically penalize you $2,000 a day if you violate your quarantine order. And so if somebody goes into quarantine three or four times, maybe it's picked up by California workman's compensation, who knows, whatever. I'm sure that would not be fun to try to fight for that. After being put in quarantine four times, you're going to say, just vaccinate me. Let me go. Like I'm done with this. Right. I think this is wearing people down. This is sort of the new form of, this is not the global war on terror. This is the global war on the virus, right? It's the invisible enemy. It's completely a disproportionate response. But it is one that really is going to change the way people behave. And we're already seeing that.
Well, here's the thing. as I said, death is not the worst thing that can happen.
It's not.
I was stunned when I looked at 666, Bill 666, to see that Marcy Kaptur was on it. I thought, what in the world? So I went and checked. They were selling this as making resources available to protect minority communities.
Oh, what that's a word. I know. Bobby Rush is African American from the South Side of Chicago. I mean, that's so appalling, is that this is being sold of, and we do know that there is absolute truth that people in the minority communities in the United States have been more susceptible. They have poorer health, they have, you know, poor access to care. They probably, the vaccine program is disproportionately harmful to people of color. We know that based on statistics. So it's tragic. I mean, and so these are the people who are going to be prioritized by this contact tracing. These are the people who are going to have one bathroom for many family members. So this is going to be targeted at people in the inner city, first and foremost, who live in relatively close quarters, who don't have the option to have, and this idea of a separate bathroom.
Can't afford to stay home and not go to work.
Right. And can't afford not to go to work. And so this is just a new form of policing. This is just a new form of over-policing of minority communities in the United States. This is sort of the new and improved policing, if you will. It is.
So one of the most, now, I'm assuming that your sheriff has the ability to override anything the contract tracers do as a matter of law.
Well, I don't have a sheriff. I think that's correct. I mean, law enforcement is still law enforcement. So the law enforcement, whether it's, you know, the police force or the sheriff, they can either issue detainment orders or they can say to their contact tracers, go to hell. We're not having it. I mean, and I said to you earlier, Catherine, I think that's the saving grace of this. I think there are lots of people in this country with common sense, and I think they're going to say, this is a waste of our money. I'm not going to let you harass our citizens with this. This doesn't make sense. If somebody's sick, they should stay home. If they're not sick, you know, the data, Catherine, on non-infectious, on asymptomatic transmission is very weak. It really does not look like people who, you know, are asymptomatic are transmitting this disease. It's people who are sick that transmit the disease.
So I became very involved with what was going on in asset forfeiture in the 90s. And I ended up hiring the attorney who had written the asset forfeiture law to help me. And then I spent a lot of time researching and dealing with what was happening in state and local government, because the whole asset forfeiture bureaucracy would move state and locally and do a lot to sort of buy people into the system. And if you look at the places where serious shenanigans occurred, the pressure to buy off the local guys, to buy off the sheriff, to buy off the police, to buy off enforcement, the pressure was very heavy and they had a lot of money to do it with. Mm-hmm. And so some places went the wrong way. And yeah. I think what I've been telling our subscribers is, look, you've got to organize a network locally to make sure your area and your sheriff go the right way.
Well, I'm 100% behind you there, Catherine. I mean, all politics is local, all law enforcement is local, right?
Right.
I mean, it's not going to be, you know, yes, one needs to have one's own network and one's own sort of safe system. Absolutely.
So let me talk, you said one thing that I want to finish on before we go on to, I want to talk about children's health defense now, but you said one thing that I thought was the most intelligent comment just about I'd heard on contact tracing. And you said, we cannot go into court on this unless we have a groundswell of popular support.
You know, I think that courts are not separate from the society at large.
Right.
There's really, really good data on that. The Supreme Court doesn't flip on a culture war issue until really, whether they're reading polls or not, until polls show that there's some support for it. You
right.
know, they had their comeuppance with abortion rights in the 1970s. They're not going to flip a switch on a culture war issue anymore until they see that essentially popular opinion has shifted.
Right.
So, you know, judges are conservative by their nature. These are not firebrands. They would not be judges if they weren't sort of conservative in their temperament, usually. So, yeah, I mean, it's not going to be just legal issues. And it's going to be because there is some popular support that this has gone too far, right? And the contact tracing issues are going to be tough, Catherine, because states do have robust authority around public health. They really
right.
do.
Right.
There's no question that states have public health authorities to isolate and to quarantine for serious infectious diseases. Now, you know, one can argue, but again, judges are not scientists. Judges are going to have a hard time saying,
right.
You know, no, this isn't really deadly. Although in New York, for instance, last year, it got no mainstream media attention, but we got a judge to say that the measles outbreak was not an epidemic and that it was not the basis for the county executive to use emergency powers and to force house arrest on children who were not vaccinated. And it was upheld on appeal. So some judges are willing to sort of, you know, do the right thing. But we showing pushing back against these agendas, pushing back against these ideas that are being floated is essential. Let me just give you one example that happened in the last few days. In March, in May, the New York State Bar Association, a professional association, came out and advocated for a coronavirus vaccine, not only for every man, woman, and child in New York State, but also at the federal level. we all need to get this. And it was clearly a wish list of the pharmaceutical and healthcare industries. Right. Well, the great thing is we at Children's Health Defense, we had a click to take action. They got 10,000 emails. They got thousands of phone calls. And they had their annual meeting on Saturday. And the fantastic thing was, is that they radically changed their recommendation. They walked it back 1,000 miles saying there has to be testing.
Fabulous.
There has to be evidence. There has to be phase 3 trials. We have to include minorities. And a mandate should be the last resort. And only if public health authorities think that it's absolutely necessary. But then even better than that was that the whole annual meeting voted not to endorse the health report that they had written about COVID-19.
Yes.
They postponed it until November because it raised really serious questions. And many of them said, we don't want to go out there recommending a vaccine that doesn't exist. So, you know, they were posturing. This was creating the sort of groundswell for the agenda for contact tracing, for, you know, mandates, and a little bit of posturing on the other side. We held a demonstration, we sent emails, you know, they walked it back. And right. So I think it's really, you know, with all of this push on contract tracing, people need to stand up and say, I'm not going to comply with that.
It's wonderful to hear what you said about Ventura County and then state of Washington, that there was.
They walked it back because right. There was a lot of public outcry. And I have to say, Catherine, I'm kind of really new to the world of social media, which you're obviously more expert with. But, you know, politicians watch Twitter. They really do. Politicians are following that information in particular. And if they see what is a groundswell, they take it under advisement.
So
I'm not saying they're going to pull back, but they're going to manipulate. They're going to go underground. They're going to find other methods. You know, they don't ever have the resources in terms of numbers that we do. They have right. money, they have the infrastructure, but they're never going to be able to mobilize people of real, you know, passion.
Care, right.
Yeah.
So I just have to tell you one story. The funniest thing I ever saw on social media, this was after the bailouts. It was about 2012 or two, you know, somewhere in that period after the bailouts, everybody's furious. Some very young, clever person at JP Morgan Chase decided that Jamie Dimon should do a chat on Twitter. So they show up, this young thing, and the Twitter social media JP Morgan Chase, and the chairman of JP Morgan, well, of course, everyone in the independent financial media had been preparing and had been preparing their tweets and was gunning for them. And it went on for 24 minutes. It's supposed to be an hour. After 24 minutes, they just disappeared.
Wow.
They just ran.
Wow.
But if you read, you know, there were just hundreds of tweets from the smartest people in the financial world. And it was like watching. It was the funniest thing. That Twitter feed is the funniest thing I've ever read. They killed him. They just killed him, and he went running with his tail between his leg.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly right.
Okay. So let's talk about Children Health Defense. And you've heard this story before. A couple times I've blown up at sort of subscribers or former clients who are asking me in this environment, what's the best way to position your wealth? And I say, you know, if you don't have an army, there's no point in having more assets because – you know, if you look at the police powers that are being used and enforced and what is going on in the financial markets, you know, people are coming to steal your assets here. It's been, you know, I've spent a lot of time in financial fraud, and this is the first time I've seen the perfect integration of sort of what I would call health fraud and financial fraud operating together, which is very scary.
Yeah.
So I've said, look, you've got to fund an army.
Yeah.
Unless you fund an army, you're not going to have assets. So one of the things we've done is we put up something called a Take Action Crowdfund. And the first two groups we asked to support, we asked them to go directly to Children Health Defense and one other, and then we have a general crowdfund. But what I want everyone who's listening to this to do is to come to your website, join. You have a great list. You post great content. I mean, if you want to understand what's going on and why the lies, you know, every time they come out with a lie, all you have to do is go to your website and hear why it's yeah. And you really, it's understandable. You make it possible for someone like me who doesn't have a science background to really understand what's going on. So I want them to become a member. I want them to support you. If you can afford to donate, even if it's just a dollar, numbers count. You know, even if everybody gave a dollar, if a million people came into your website and gave a dollar, that's political power. That really counts. So don't think, you know, don't think it's, you know, I don't have enough money to make a difference. You do. You have enough money to make a difference. So tell us a little bit about what Children's Health Defense is doing now and how you can use more resources to really make a difference in this time.
Thank you so much, Catherine. We're so grateful for your support and for that of your members. So Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is our chair and he's our general, and he is in this fight for the long haul. You know, there are things worse than death, and he's going to fight this fight to his last breath. He really is. And so we have an amazing team of scientists and lawyers and advocates, and our mission is to protect children's health, to expose those harmful exposures that are causing our children to be sick, and to hold the culpable actors accountable and to prevent this ever happening in the future. And candidly, we can't really protect children at this point without protecting their parents and adults, and they're coming after all of us now, Catherine. Right. You know, maybe up until February or January, they were mostly gunning for kids when it came to the vaccine compulsory program. They're now gunning for everybody worldwide. So for sure, our rubric includes adults to the extent that they're necessary for children's health. We do research, we do advocacy, we do education, but we also do litigation. So they're not separable, Catherine. We have to have sort of the information. We have to be cultivating our membership. As you said, it's you can become a member for life for $10. It's really important for us to be able to show the world we have hundreds of thousands of members. We don't speak for 10 people. We speak for hundreds of thousands. We have in the millions who are looking at our website, and we're in the process of translating into a number of different languages so that we really can reach people around the world. We're creating state chapters, we're creating international chapters, but a really important part of what we do in terms of being the spear, being the army to push back against this sort of the billionaire's war against people, which is really what it is, we litigate. So I'm an attorney. Bobby Kennedy is an attorney. We have other attorneys on staff and that we work with around the country. And we are fighting back against the repeal of the religious exemption in New York. We're fighting back on the narrowing of the medical exemption in New York. We're fighting back against the mandate that was imposed in 4 zip codes in Brooklyn for measles vaccines last year. That's the prototype for what they're going to do with the coronavirus. We're fighting back against censorship in California. We're fighting in Tennessee on behalf of a severely injured child from vaccines. That case is really going to expose that vaccines absolutely do cause autism. It's in Jackson, Tennessee, and it's scheduled for
really?
Yeah.
You know, my father's family is from Jackson.
I'll be there. It's going to be a big trial. It's going to be in November. And we're doing a lot. But the biggest case that we have not yet filed, Catherine, we're working on now. And that's a case that really exposes the overarching fraud that we have been living with for decades. And so we're working very intensively, and we really genuinely believe that, as you've called it, this is a syndicate. This is a mafia-like organization that is public and private, and it's only getting stronger right now in the era of COVID.
The game of the invisible enemy virus along with the vaccination, I cannot tell you how profitable this is, not just to make money on injections, but to cover up so many different financial liabilities and to protect the insurance industry from all sorts of financial liabilities, yeah. Let alone when we talk about, you know, what a brain machine interface could do. So the profits here are phenomenal, unbelievable.
Well, I think one of the things I've learned from you and from the Solari report is really to add the financial dimension to this. I think we focus on sort of the harms from the physical vaccines, which are enormous. and the lack of adequate legal infrastructure for that and the liability protection. But we don't really, first and foremost, focus on the money flows. And I think what you make so clear is this is a money machine, right? This is this invisible enemy, these sort of the vaxiah, right? The messiah in the form of a vaccine. This is an incredible, and it's a forced market, right? It's a captive market. Really following the money, I think, is another thing that people of common sense really understand. So we're working hard. We also are working on other issues too, besides vaccines, Catherine. We're working on 5G, the harms from radio magnetic frequencies. So we've got a really major lawsuit right now against the Federal Communications Corporation on behalf of Children's Health Defense. We're also suing a baby food manufacturer, Beechnut, because they claim that their baby food was natural, but in fact it contained glyphosate, which is extremely damaging to infants. So we're busy, and we're enormously grateful for anyone who, you can sign up for our newsletter for free. We invite you to do that. We think that it is excellent information that we're putting out. It's very, you know, full of references and citations. But we also would really invite you to join and become a lifetime member for $10. And you know what, as you point out, Catherine, those $10 contributions really add up to
us. They really add up.
We get, you know, we get significant money every month from people who've signed up for a lifetime membership, and we're profoundly grateful. We're a nonprofit organization, so we survive on contributions from people.
So I'm going to tell you another reason to join. And I've heard this more than a few times, but we just had a subscriber who I was dying to hear about how things went in Albany. So I emailed her. I said, we'll pay your expenses if you'll go up and cover it. And she came back, and the first, you know, she said it again and again. What a great bunch of people. You want to meet great people?
You know, I have to say, I was there, and I'm proud to have been, you know, part of the team that put that together. And it was a beautiful day. It was people from all walks of life, all parts of the state, all political persuasions, religious beliefs, all different colors. And it was peaceful. It was fun. And what's amazing to me, Catherine, is we put it, it was live streamed on the High Wire with Dell Bigtree's website. And on
Great.
We have over 300,000 people have watched that rally already.
That doesn't surprise me.
You know, we really do have numbers. We really do. And I think it's really important that we get that word out to the powers that be. You are not going to be able to pull this off without, you know, people standing up and fighting back.
Well, I'm always telling people you've got to hang out with people who have great integrity. And my feedback is anytime everybody gets involved with a group that's, you know, doing something locally with Children's Health Defense, they come back and they say, I found my people, I found my tribe, I found my family.
It was a really happy day. It was a sad day because it was the anniversary of the year when 26,000 children were thrown out of school in New York State. And there were, you know, parents who were outraged, and there were a lot of kids there, but it was a happy day that we had come together. We were standing up for our rights and we were sending a message, and sending our message actually seems to have had a major result.
Right. So you're not alone. You're not alone. They're, you know, at all.
No. So it was a good day.
Okay. So give everyone your website, your URL.
So our website is childrenshealthdefense.org. No apostrophe, no grammar, childrenshealthdefense.org. And you can sign up there for the newsletter. You can donate there. You can become a lifetime member. You can send questions and comments to the contact button. And we're really grateful for any engagement.
So the last thing I want to say, because, you know, you've been a hero on the Salieri Report. So you've been here, and Bobby Kennedy, Robert Kennedy's been a hero on this. Both of you have. Everyone who knows me knows that if you really want me to lose my temper and attack you, all you have to do is say that nobody's doing anything. So you and your colleagues are my proof that somebody is doing plenty.
We're working hard, Catherine, and we know you are, and we're so grateful for your work. And as I've told you, I'm learning so much from your report and from your website and from the videos that you've done. I think you're just doing remarkable work.
Well, if we can ever help, we're here to support. So
we're extremely grateful.
We're willing for things to work out.
I really do believe we can win this. And one of the things I was mentioning to you before we started, you were talking with James Corbett. One of the things I think would help our movement, and I think you're really well poised to do this, is to help people imagine what does it look like after we beat the billionaire bullies? What does that look like? If we're not buying into their globalist ideology, what does that picture of human freedom and greater local control, what does that really look like?
You know something, and you know, a longer conversation, and I talked about it with James, It is so hard to imagine the destruction of wealth that occurs as a result of central control, let alone tyranny. And once you've grappled with what happens, you know, so life happens sort of, you know, living things, people, animals, plants, environments, they operate in ecosystems, in places. And if you could realign your financial and economic system around the optimization of life within places, the wealth potential, the first time I realized how big it was, ever since then, I can't stop laughing because, you know, we have forgotten how shrunk down individually we have become. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the day... Imagine America where 54% of the children do not have chronic disease.
Oh, my God. Exactly.
Remember the day potential. Remember the day when kids could run out and play. Right.
I know.
So yeah. I don't know if you ever heard the, you know, the different comedy routines about street football in Philadelphia, but we would roam free. We had room to roam. And at you know, that was a very rich and wonderful world. And it's very sad because kids today don't remember what that kind of world could be. But if you look at the financial wealth potential, get ready for everybody to be a billionaire. It's astonishing what could happen if we could achieve civilization. So that's why I'm a perpetual optimist. And I don't underestimate the expense of this fight. But the one thing I will tell you, having been through a legal and financial fight where it was considered hopeless that I could win, what I came to learn was, you know, regularly I was asked to choose between freedom and my life, and I chose freedom. And then all of a sudden, everything would reorganize and an option that wasn't there would open up. You know?
Yep.
So you have to, you know, we call it in Christendom, we call it standing. You know, we have to stand for the values and principles that we want to have. And that's why I keep saying death is not the worst thing that could happen here at all. So, you know, we have to determine where our line is and we have to hold that line. And I think we can if enough people, it doesn't take everybody, but you've seen, if you look at the membership that you have, what they've been able to accomplish, every time I look at what you are accomplishing, because I know how hard and expensive litigation is, when I see the things you accomplish, I just think, God, they have a fantastic return on investment. Put some more money in their gas tank. Anyway, so Mary Holland, thank you for educating us. Anytime you think we need to get smart about something, let us know and okay. We'll do this again.
I will.
Okay?
I will, Captain.
And you
thank
have
you.
A wonderful day. Bye.
You too. Bye-bye.